This podcast is sponsored by El Spelio, maker of some of the greatest caving lights on the planet. And right now, available on elspelio.com, the Lunatic, which is their top-of-the-line light. But if you see the price of the Lunatic and you think, I don't know about that. Also available is the El Spelio Grinta 1700, which that might be a little more doable for you. Either way, you're going to get one of the best caving lights you can buy. Doug imports El Spelios to the United States and sells them via elspelio.com. And when you think about it, if you consider how much you go caving and you consider the money that you've invested in other areas of your caving gear, think about how much you've spent on your light, which is one of the most important pieces of gear you carry with you. Now, you might be happy with your less expensive light. You might not go caving often enough to justify an El Spelio. And that's fine. If you do, though, you won't regret getting one. I link you to elspelio.com in the description of this podcast. And if you're going to buy one, use the promo code PODCAST to save $20 off any regularly priced order over $300. Elspelio.com, promo code PODCAST, and up your light game. Welcome to the Caving Podcast. I'm your host, Matt Pelser of the Central Indiana Grotto, former chairman and active member, also an active member of the Indiana Karst Conservancy, member of the SCCI, member of the NSS. What are all these acronyms? The CIG is the Central Indiana Grotto. The NSS is the National Speleological Society. SCCI is the Southeastern Cave Conservancy. All great organizations, and there are many, many more that you can choose to be a part of. Basically, this is the world of organized caving. If you're here because you think being in a wild cave sounds like fun to you, great. You're our people. However, you got to do it right. And in fact, there are a number of rules that we have when it comes to caving, and joining your local grotto will inform you of those rules, and you'll also make friends to go caving with. So I've included a link in the description of this podcast to help you find your local grotto. And when you do, you can find the leadership, send some emails, find out when meetings are, and get underground. Caving can be really, really safe if you know what you're doing, quite the opposite if you don't. So just got to say that at the top here. I'm really, really excited to bring you this episode. I got to talk with director Jonathan Bird and cave diver and contributor Todd Kelly, who worked on the IMAX and OmniMax or IMAX Dome film Ancient Caves, which is in several theaters right now. At the time, it was only in a couple. And we'll get to the list of theaters where it's either showing or coming later on in this introduction. I'm proud to report that I am caving today. If you're listening to this the day it comes out on May 1st, I'm caving today. It's great. I don't get to go caving that often. I got little kids, and that keeps me at home a lot. And my outdoor life has really calmed down since we've had kids 4 years ago, almost 5 years ago now. And so then even happier when I do get to go caving. And I'm happy to report that I'm taking new people today, people who have never gone before, people who are really, really excited to try it. So where am I going? Buckner, of course. I mean, you probably could have guessed it. If you listen to this podcast, you know that I always go to Buckner Cave in Indiana. You know, I like taking new people. I am familiar with it. It's got everything I want. So I'm going to be having fun there today. I wish I could say I'm going to the National Convention June 13th through the 17th in Rapid City, South Dakota. I cannot make it. I had planned to go, but that's the week before I go on vacation in Colorado, and it's just not going to work. I mean, I don't have enough vacation days at work, and my family needs me. I will make it to a convention at some point, but it's not going to happen this year. And I'll make it out to South Dakota at some point, convention or not. So you South Dakota cavers, get ready to get some emails from me sometime in the next few years. Want to come caving out there. Speaking of events, my grotto, the Central Indiana Grotto, hosts Indiana Cave Capers August 5th through the 7th. If you want to come to Indiana and see what we've got to offer, it's very close to the cave area, right in it. Camp River Vale, again, August 5th through the 7th. And I don't know, I might be leading a trip. I might just go and go with people. I'm really looking forward to it. It's the one I never miss. I'll bring my microphones, maybe conduct some impromptu interviews again. At least I hope so. Indiana Cave Capers, Camp River Vale, August 5th through the 7th. All right, this is a short intro this time. Thank goodness, right? So this was such a cool interview. Thank you to Matt Bowers in California for hooking me up with Jonathan Bird and Todd Kelly, who worked on the film Ancient Caves, which is narrated, by the way, by Bryan Cranston of Breaking Bad. Super cool. And according to the website, if you just Google Ancient Caves, it'll take you to McGilvery Freeman.com. And according to that website, it is coming soon to the Fleet Science Center in San Diego, California. It is available for school groups in Fort Lauderdale at the Museum of Discovery and Science. It is now playing in Boston at the Museum of Science. It's coming to St. Louis Science Center July 1st. It's coming to Discovery Place in Charlotte, North Carolina. It's now playing in Cincinnati at the Museum Center. And it's coming soon to Tennessee Aquarium in Chattanooga and Moody Gardens in Galveston, Texas. And internationally, it's playing in Lucerne, Switzerland at the Swiss Museum of Transport, and in Beijing at the China Science and Technology Museum and the Hong Kong Space Museum in Hong Kong. So if you're near any of that, go and see it. And if you've got a big screen near you, contact them and ask them to bring it to you. And we'll talk a little bit more about that toward the end. I am proud to welcome Jonathan Bird and Todd Kelly to talk about the film Ancient Caves. So we are with Jonathan Bird and Todd Kelly. Jonathan Bird directed the new IMAX movie, Ancient Caves, and Todd was involved as well. Welcome, guys.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Hi. Morning.
So, Jonathan, we'll start with you. I saw a little bit of the NSS presentation that you gave for the what would have been the national convention last year. You're a diver from way back. And you had this series, that was on PBS and then on YouTube. And you sort of made a foray into the cave world in about, what was it, like 2013 or something like that?
Yeah, something like that, 2013 or 14. So, yeah, I mean, I have this this show, Jonathan Bird's Blue World. It's an underwater science adventure show. And Todd is one of our camera guys and our legal department and our graphics guy. He wears many hats.
He's Don't also, we all? That's great.
Yeah.
He's also our resident cave diver. Todd's been cave diving for like 30 years, and he's been ragging on me to get cave certified like for a decade. And we started doing some episodes. We got invited down to the Riviera Maya to do some episodes down there. And we did some cenote dives. And of course, you know, I wasn't cave certified, so we couldn't really get into these cenotes, but they will take you into some pretty good cenotes where you're still in the cavern zone, but you get the cave diving feel, you know? And I kind of got the bug a little bit. I was like, I didn't think I'd ever really get into like cave diving. I'm more of a fish guy, you know? And I kind of got the bug a little bit. And Todd was like, well, you know, hey man, let's get you certified and then we can do more cave diving episodes. And let me tell you, dude, that was a slippery slope. Very slippery slope.
Yeah. Now we're doing much more cave diving now.
Well, our fans are like, is this the cave diving show? What is this?
Well, yeah, because when you get into that world, there's just an awful lot that you can cover that hasn't been covered because not a lot of people do this. And Todd, I've only talked to a few cave divers on the podcast before. I'm so glad you're here because it's a world that is fascinating to me. It's not one that I ever think that I'll enter anytime soon, but I am a caver. I've never been scuba diving. I don't know that I'll marry the two, but you've been at it for, gosh, he said 3 decades?
Yeah, I started cave diving in 93, actually.
Wow.
So maybe not quite that long, but I mean, I've been diving since about 81. So I got certified in 81, worked at a few dive shops, and I went to college. My first year of college was down in Melbourne, Florida. And during spring break, a friend of mine who was just open water certified like I was, we went to Ginny Springs. And you could see the cave divers sort of coming out. And as soon as you could see, just get a peek of from their lights of like the entrance to the caves and them coming out, you know, with all the gear and everything. As soon as I saw it, I'm like, I want to do that. And so it took me a few years to sort of get the funds and the courage and everything together. And I went down in 93 and got certified with some of my friends that I was diving with in New England at the time.
Well, and the courage is a big part of it, right? I mean, with the thing that I've noticed in talking to cave divers is that they have a way about them that is very calm. You must have a very slow resting heart rate.
Yeah, I'm more comfortable in the water than out. I definitely, the water calms me down. In cave diving, you know, I like the darkness. I like the adventure of it all. And so I find it very soothing and relaxing to be back there. That also comes with experience. But I remember in one of the things you do in training is you do lights out drills where you have to find and follow a line while you're blind and there's no lights in the cave. And I remember it being a level of darkness that, and I'm sure you're familiar with this, that you just don't experience anywhere else. Like when there are no lights, it's a weirdly unsettling, disorienting experience when you're floating, free floating in the water and have no reference whatsoever. And I thought that was awesome and sort of very calming and peaceful. Managed to find the line and we made our way out. Probably go for a few hundred yards during the training in that total darkness. And you're, feeling to make sure you don't swim into rocks or anything while you follow the line out. And the instructor's trying to like pull the line away from your hand to make sure you're really holding on to it. But yeah, that was a great experience. Led me to pursuing cave diving for many, many years. I find one of the biggest challenges is just finding good partners. And Jonathan's I'm so glad that he became a cave diver because he and I are great dive partners and we work very well together.
And Jonathan, I want to come back to you, but I have one more question for Todd in this line of questioning. So Todd, sounds like diving came first and then cave diving obviously has to come second, but was there caving in between or part of it? Was there dry caving?
I wish there were. But I really, because I was living in New England, there's not much in the way of caves. I mean, there's a few, you could almost consider them caves, but kind of overhangs up in New Hampshire where it's, maybe there's 100 feet or something. But there really isn't a lot of access there. And I didn't, in those days, there wasn't the internet communities to the same extent there are today. There were, something called Usenet groups and others, but the information really wasn't there. And I couldn't find a partner that was willing to go explore some dry caving. Once I started the wet cave diving, that just became the focus. Like if I got the time and the money to get away, I would just end up going cave diving or diving. And so I think that was a little bit of a distraction as well.
So Jonathan, aside from making this documentary, any dry caving for you as well? You're more of a diver guy.
First of all, dry caving is a misnomer.
All caving is wet. This is true.
It's
yes.
How disgusting and uncomfortable it is. When you're cave diving, the wet cave is an enjoyable experience. And when you're just caving, the wet cave is a very cold and muddy experience.
Yeah.
No, we did a fair amount of dry caving making Ancient Caves because Gina Mosley, who's our main character, who's a climatologist that uses the formations in caves to look at the ancient climate, which is the name Ancient Caves. We all know that caves are ancient, but she's looking at ancient climate through caves. She's not a cave diver. She does all of her work in muddy caves. So we had to join her on a whole bunch of expeditions, which was a ton of fun. I really had a blast, but it's definitely a lot more work to dry cave than it is to cave dive. But before that, I really hadn't, other than going in a couple of show caves in my travels, when you're on a path and, it's been lit for you. I mean, I've been in a number of those in a number of places, but that's not caving, that's being a tourist. So this film was really my complete introduction to the real caving, where you really get dirty.
Okay, so I want to go back to something you said that it's more work to dry cave than it is to cave dive. Now, that may be the case for you, but for me, someone who's never gone cave diving before, it seems okay. So the work might I see what you're saying. The work might be physical in dry caving, but to me, the mental load of cave diving has got to be huge. Maybe it's not for you, especially not for Todd, because you've been doing it for so long. What do you think, Jonathan?
Well, if you are properly trained and you're comfortable in the water, I mean, I'm a cave diver. I got cave certified after I'd been diving for 27 years. So I'm very comfortable in the water. It's what I do for a living. Like Todd, it's my happy place. And so you think you've seen everything and done everything, and now you take a cave class and you're learning a whole new skill. You're taking your diving to the next level. To me, it was really fun. It wasn't terribly challenging to learn the skills. It's just you had to practice and learn the skills, but I found it enjoyable. And then once you're cave certified, you're comfortable in the water, and being in the caves is, like Todd said, it's very relaxing and peaceful. And I get excited and happy to go cave diving. I'm not, there's the mental load of like, oh my God, I'm going to drown. Like it's not there. And there's a perception that cave diving is extremely dangerous. And, you know, historically there have been a lot of accidents where people have died cave diving, and they're almost always not trained and not using the right equipment, and they don't know what they're doing. And the fact of the matter is that if you are following the rules, if you're following your training, you have the right equipment, you're doing it correctly, cave diving is safer than a lot of sports. I mean, I think statistically it's safer than skiing. It's a very safe sport if you don't break the rules. There's rules for a reason. And those rules are designed to keep you alive. And as long as you don't break those rules, it's a very, very safe sport.
Todd, having done it for a little longer than Jonathan, I don't know. Do you have an echo to that?
No, I agree. I mean, it comes down to the training. In dry caving, I had some rock climbing experience. I did do quite a bit of that. And I think that, you know, the skills there map very well into caving. So the physical exertion and effort is a lot higher. And I'd say there's, for dry caving, you're probably going to encounter a lot more injuries, even though they're minor. The thing about cave diving is the mistakes tend to be very costly, as are the big mistakes in dry caving as well. I mean, so both have some tenant amount of risk, but you know, with the training and with using the systems properly and testing them properly, following the rules and the training, it can be done and executed safely. But in all situations, I mean, caves are dangerous places. So when things go wrong, they can go very wrong very quickly.
So Todd, where has your cave diving life taken you? You mentioned, you know, Ginny Springs and a couple other places, but what are some other highlights?
Let's see. Florida, the caves in Florida are where I started. So I always have a soft spot in my heart for those. But also Mexico. I mean, Mexico, below ground in the caves there, is just an untapped wonderland. So many miles of caves. I think the largest underwater cave in the world is there now, which was a series of systems that they had connected. And you're looking at, I think, 240 kilometers of continuous cave. And it's all, you know, crystal blue water that's warm, relatively shallow. So you can do very long, safe dives without massive decompression. In Florida, you know, there's some very large cave systems there as well, but they tend to run very deep quickly. So you start getting limited by your decompression abilities and having to mix gases. So everything gets more complicated in that realm. And so it requires a higher effort of planning. Where else? Nevada, Devil's Hole, which, you know, we feature in ancient caves, was just an extraordinary experience and unlike any cave system I'd ever experienced. I mean, it had these smooth white walls and, you know, the fact that you're surrounded by desert and nothing, there's no civilization or sign of civilization around. That was awesome.
Well, also the fact that you're in the middle of a desert, you're in the middle of the hottest place in the United States, and you go down into this cave and there's this beautiful blue crystal clear water.
Just keeps going.
One of the largest aquifers in our country.
Wow.
Under Death Valley.
Well, it's where it all went, right? Isn't it?
My mind is blown. Todd, you don't forget Abaco.
And Abaco, of course. Yeah. Yes. I can't forget about Abaco. The crystal
one of the most
caves.
Beautiful caves in the entire world.
Wow.
Yes. The crystal structures, you know, light passes right through them. And there's something called the rain room, which again, we show in the film. And it just looks like rain has crystallized in the room, and the way the light hits it is just unbelievably gorgeous, and it's extraordinarily fragile. But you know, that was very stressful because we knew that just move in the wrong direction even slightly, you're gonna crush and break things, and Brian might not let you out of the cave. So we had this fear of Brian, which was a new kind of pressure. He does a great job managing that cave system down there and protecting it because it's such a fragile ecosystem. With all the crystal structures, that it's you have to be very careful and very on top of your game to navigate that without doing any damage to the cave.
Forgive me,
which
Brian.
Is what we always try to do.
Brian who?
Brian K. Cook.
Brian K.
Cook. He's also one of the leads in the film and was actually Jonathan's cave diving instructor.
Oh, fantastic!
He's one of the world's top cave explorers, and he settled in the Bahamas because the caves there are the most beautiful in the world. And he has kind of become the de facto guardian of the Crystal Caves of Abaco, as he's the only instructor on the island that takes people cave diving. And he's, you know, made a lot of effort to get these caves turned into national parks and protected, which he has done. And if you go diving with him, you will have to demonstrate proficiency before he will take you into any of the sensitive parts of the caves. And so that was kind of a treat for me. I went to him for my cave training, and I figured if I'm going to do this, I'm going to learn from one of the best. So I went to Abaco and I did my cave training with him, and Todd went along and filmed it all so we could make a Blue World episode out of it. So we actually made a Blue World episode out of my training. And then the gift at the end was, if I do well enough, he'll take me into a couple of the really beautiful decorated rooms. So I got to see, what is it? The crystal, it's the frozen rain room, basically.
The rain room. Crystal Palace.
And sort of as my graduation present. And then we made an episode out of that. So that was pretty cool. So it's kind of like I got trained by a Jedi master. And it's, the interesting thing was that I did my training in the caves that most people think of as the Mount Everest of cave diving, the, like the place you go, you know, when you really want to finally see the best caves in the world, you go to Abaco. And that's where I did my training. Like, like, that's where I did my,
you did it backwards.
But of course I wasn't in the really beautiful parts. I was in the, you know, the kind of more boring parts where you do your training. Then when I went to Florida, like most people get trained in Florida, and I went to Florida for the first time, and, you know, I had never been there. It was like really weird. Like, so it's been really fun going around the world and getting to see all these different caves now that I'm certified.
Yeah, Abaco also was sort of brought about the film, actually. Once we saw Abaco and saw the crystal caves there, we're like, oh, we've got to go bigger with this. And that sort of led us down the path to IMAX, because it's one of the better formats to really show caves and cave diving. You look at so much cave video, and it's usually a GoPro on somebody's helmet, and you don't get a good sense of what those caves and caverns are like. But, you know, Jonathan had the idea of, hey, let's do this in IMAX, like on a dome. And that would truly give people an experience like they haven't been before, that's much closer to what it's like to be there. And he was 100% spot on with that. Once you see it in a dome or in the 3D, I think it's as close as you'll ever get to actually being there without, you know, going through the training and all the steps to make your way swimming there.
Well, and indeed, one of the theaters that it's playing in, right? I only know about the Cincinnati one because I've actually been there, the Robert D. Linder family, Omnimax, actually, Museum of Natural History there in Cincinnati. I've been there several times, haven't seen this film yet, but it's playing there now. So let's get into that part. So Jonathan, you're also the director of cinematography. Mm-hmm. IMAX cameras have changed a lot over the years. A decade ago, you couldn't have made this movie, right?
Yeah, this film was made possible by advancements in digital cameras. We did shoot some of the above water stuff in the film with a traditional 70mm IMAX camera, just because I'm a little bit of a traditionalist and it's fun.
Why not?
But, you know, getting back to what Todd said, so, you know, I'm from Boston, and our IMAX theater in Boston is what they currently call an IMAX dome theater, but what they originally called an Omnimax theater. So it was a format that was introduced in the 70s that would immerse the audience. It was like basically combining the advantages of a planetarium with a theater. And so you're shooting it with a fisheye lens, and you're projecting onto a curved screen that surrounds the audience 180 degrees. And it creates this feeling of immersion that you're actually in that place. And it's a very difficult format to work in, but when it's done correctly, it's absolutely unbelievable in the theater. And because only 20% of the IMAX theaters are actually Omnimax theaters, they don't actually get a lot of good content. They don't get a lot of films that look that great. And so being from Boston, and our theater is an Omnimax, and I kind of grew up going to the Omnimax, I really wanted to make a film for the Omnimax theaters. It's sort of my love for the format and, you know, doing something fun. And of course, if you shoot it properly, it'll look great on the 3D screens too. It's just a matter of you have to take both screens into account when you're shooting it if you really want it to look good on the dome. So we were trying to think of what would be a good subject for an IMAX film that would look good on domes. And we had just finished a giant screen film about underwater astronaut training. And what we had learned in that was we had shot in the neutral buoyancy lab in Houston, which is this gigantic swimming pool where the astronauts train. And there were things all around us, you know what I mean? So when you see it on a dome, you can look up and you can see the surface of the pool and the structures going over your head. And it was a very immersive feel. But then we did a bunch of scenes at Aquarius where the astronauts train, and it was just in the ocean. And when you look up, all you just see is like the surface of the water. And it's like, it's okay, but it's like, doesn't do much. We're like, where can we film where there would be something to see like all around us, you know? So no matter which way you look in the dome, there's going to be something cool. You're really going to feel like you're in someplace. And, you know, we were kind of thinking of ideas. And then we went to Abaco to make this Blue World episode. And Todd and I were like, we came out of the water. We looked at each other. We're like, we just found our IMAX film. And that was the moment when we were like, this is the place. This will give people an unbelievable thing to see that they'll never see anywhere else in a way that they would never see it unless they were actually cave diving. So we can take people cave diving. And if you can see it, it's the film's great in 3D on the flat screen too. The 3D version came out amazing. But if you can see it on the dome in Cincinnati, you'll really be seeing it in a way that will make you feel like you are cave diving. Mm. So on the dome, it's in 2D. I would say it's interesting. I'd say about 50% of the film is better on the dome and about 50% of the film is better in 3D. So you should kind of see it on both. But you're very lucky because not everybody is near an OmniMax theater. So Cincinnati is one of the best OmniMax theaters in the country. It has a brand new IMAX laser projection system that's super bright and contrasty, and it looks terrific. We actually, that theater is one of the seven theaters that helped fund the film. And so we did some of our preliminary screenings in that theater when we were looking at dailies and stuff. So that theater, we're very familiar with that theater. It's just a perfect place to see the film. So go see it.
It's going to happen, man. It's definitely going to happen. I wish I could say I saw it before we got to talk, but it just didn't happen. So Todd, the two of you see this place and you get the inspiration. All right, this is where we're going. Any moments leading up to that or since that moment where you were like, well, maybe this instead, or and indeed you went to other places, right?
Yeah, well, you know, we still had to come up with the story because, you know, we had a location that we wanted to use and certainly shoot.
Can't just show pictures and not have anything to say.
Well, yeah, there's some part of the IMAX industry or the dome theater industry that seems to follow that approach. But we're trying to be storytellers principally, actually.
Always so better when that's the case. Yeah.
Yeah. So having a reason for things and why we're in places, and we came across some of the people doing the science up in Minnesota, which led us to Gina Mosley, who's one of the leading climatologists and does a lot of the research on the Greenland caves. And now I think now she's teaching at the University of Innsbruck. But once we had her, she was just a fantastic, fantastic subject. And she helped us really pull the story together because she is going into the caves and pulling out samples from the caves, also the stalagmites and stalactites. She samples those and then dates them through radioisotopes so she can get very accurate pictures of the climate, what the climates were doing by looking at the formation of the cave systems at the sedimentary or the rock level. And she basically shaves them down, analyzes every layer that was created within the core sample she gets, and then uses that to both date and get a sense of what the temperature was back then. And this results in very precise measurement of the geological temperature over time. And so that led us to the locations that she had, which was like Grotte de Gornier in France. And then she was doing work in Death Valley. So we teamed up with those and we're actually in the film, we're shooting the real science that's going on. So while the story in that sense came together, it came together around real things that are happening about our real climate and how it's being studied. So we got very lucky there, actually. We couldn't have asked for a better story. And then Jonathan and Art Cohen did a great job, like writing the story and pulling it all together and making it understandable for the audience.
I have followed a little bit of Gina's work, Dr. Gina Mosley, and it really is incredible. In fact, I saw a presentation given by Dr. Hazel Barton on that the Greenland trip that you mentioned. And some of the work that she did there, that the two of them did there, just incredible. And so when we look at the title of this film, Ancient Caves, I mean, it's particularly applicable in this case when you're talking about collecting samples from caves of speleothems that are underwater because they needed the room to grow in dry passage and then the caves flooded. So do we then have any idea as to the age of some of these formations that were then looked at? And then what was the resolution explored in the film, Jonathan?
It's funny because one of Gina's grad students is studying the speleothem that we brought out of Abaco and is doing he's actually doing his, I think it's his master's thesis on the data that's come out of that. And it's basically sea level data. And also, looking at the origin of the red rings, the red layers that are believed to be Sahara dust in those. And so actually we have a copy of his preliminary master's thesis that came out of that. It's kind of interesting because, you know, when we first talked to Gina, actually, it's a really funny story how we found Gina. I want to tell this story because it's really funny.
Let's do it.
So we've made the decision that we're going to make this cave film, but it can't just be a Jonathan and Todd go cave diving, you know, Bill and Ted's excellent cave diving adventure. it's got to be a little bit more. So we're trying to find a story, something interesting that's going on in caves. And of course I'm trying to find out what kind of science might be going on in caves that would make a good story. Because remember, I'm new to caves. Like this, I'm a diver that has just learned how to cave dive, and I'm fascinated with the environment from a filmmaker's point of view. And a filmmaker is always trying to find a good story for his film, right? So I'm Googling like what kind of I'm literally just Googling like science in caves, you know. And I come across an article about a guy named Dr. Larry Edwards, who is something called a cave paleoclimatologist at the University of Minnesota, Minnesota of all places. So I called him up and we started to talk and I said, hey, would you be open to like working on a proposal for a concept here of a film about your work in caves? And he's like, yeah, sure. So we talked some more and I said, well, you know, maybe what we should do is maybe we should come out to Minnesota and, you know, go out and do a shoot with you in one of these local caves. There's local caves in Minnesota that they do a lot of their work in. They take a lot of their students into pretty good caves, actually. And I'm like, maybe we could just, you know, come out and do some shooting with you. And he goes, oh, well, I don't go in caves. and I'm like, what? And he goes, oh man, I'm claustrophobic. Like I'm more of a lab guy. It turns out that he's sort of the father of this science. He figured out how, he didn't invent the process, but he figured out how to make it 10 times more accurate, meaning it can go 10 times further back into the past by analyzing with a mass spectrometer these samples and looking at how the isotopes decay. And so he's really more of a lab guy, and he had sort of the world's best clean room mass spectrometer at the University of Minnesota for doing this work. And I said, oh, well, who's your Indiana Jones? Who is your like field scientist that goes out and gets the samples and like works with you on this? Like, who's your Indiana Jones? And he says, oh, well, that would be Dr. Gina Mosley. And I'm like, well, can you introduce me? And, you know, and I'm thinking at the same time, I'm thinking, oh my God, that's so great. She's a woman, because you can't just have a whole film full of like white guys, like going caving. You know what I mean? Like you got to have some other personalities and stuff. You got to have diversity.
Absolutely.
And I'm like, and so, you know, I didn't say to him, who's your woman?
You just said, who's the best?
Jones. I said, who's your Indiana Jones? Like, who's the best one you got? And he's like, Gina Mosley. So we called her up and we said, and she's British. She's got this great accent. And I called her up. I'm like, so I'm trying to make this film. And, you know, would you be interested in working on it? She's like, oh, that would be lovely. Sure, I'd be happy to do that. Right. So, so she turns out she was going to be in Minnesota in a couple of months. And I thought, oh, we're going to go out. We'll meet her. We'll maybe go in a cave, you know, do some filming, see what happens. So we set it all up to go out there. And we went out for our first shoot. And what we shot on that first shoot is in the film. All the stuff when we were in the caves in Minnesota is in the film. We weren't sure if it would be, but I mean, it was, you know, the stuff was great. She was a natural. She's not an actor, but she's pretty comfortable on camera, and she's just herself in the film. That's her real self, you know, where she doesn't, you know, she's not acting. She's just doing her thing. We might have had her do a you know, pick up a sample two or three times until we got the camera angle right, you know what I mean? But she's just being Gina in the film, and she's terrific. She's an awesome star, but she doesn't scuba dive, right? Remember now, Todd and I want to go scuba diving. Okay. So I said to Gina, I said, okay, so, you know, where should we film with you? And she's like, oh, well, we should go to Grotte de Grenier in France and we can do some work in Devil's Hole. And you know, and then we were like, well, wait, can we dive in Devil's Hole? And like the Park Service does not let anyone dive in Devil's Hole. And she's like, well, we have a special permit and we might be able to piggyback you on our permit and we could do some diving. And we were like, and so when we told Brian K. Cook that we were going to dive in Devil's Hole, he basically would have paid us to be on the shoot. We should have gotten Brian to pay us to be on the crew because he probably would have, because nobody gets to dive there. And so what we said to Gina was, well, Gina, like, what can we do for you underwater? And she said, well, actually, one of our grad students has a hypothesis about one of the ions or one of the isotopes. There was a theory that they would become either more or less with depth, and I can't remember.
They would layer with depth, basically.
And they had a hypothesis that this might be the reason that they were getting a very odd anomaly in their samples. Okay, so we needed a sample from 300 feet. And so Brian, being a super deep technical cave diver, was willing to go down to 300 feet and get water samples for her. And that became the focus of the underwater part of the Devil's Hole sequence. So she's there doing her normal core sampling above, just above the waterline in the cave. And Brian is going to 300 feet for a water sample. It's interesting because the water sample ended up disproving the hypothesis, therefore contributing greatly to the body of knowledge, but not making a very interesting story. Mm. It's not like you're going to be like in the film, like, well, Brian went to 300 feet and he got this water sample and it proved head explodes, this incredible thing we didn't know before. Actually, it disproved it, which is super boring, but that's how science works. So in the film, he goes and he gets the water sample, and we kind of never circle back to that in the film because it doesn't make a very interesting story to say that it disproved it. But we still got to go scuba diving in Devil's Hole and talk about this whole concept of collecting water samples. But then when we went to Abaco, I basically said to Gina, like, Gina, what can we do for you that would be interesting in Abaco? And she says, well, you know, we've always wanted to analyze a sample from a certain depth because the Bahamas are very, very stable from a plate tectonics point of view, in that the elevation of the caves has been very constant. So when the water table has fluctuated, it's a very accurate measuring stick of sea level change because the seafloor didn't move, it stayed. And so she sent Brian on a mission to get a sample in the caves in Abaco, which has become a very good piece of science. And so we were able to film the whole process of Brian going to find that sample. And that became a great sequence in the film. It worked out great for everybody. Todd and I got to go cave diving.
Yeah.
We got to film and show on an IMAX screen the most beautiful caves in the world. So the audience gets to go cave diving in one of the most beautiful caves in the world. And we contributed to Gina's science in a way that she couldn't do it without us. So I just say, like, cave divers rock.
And Todd, Jonathan brings up some great points about access. So like in the caving world, access is a thing. Cavers listening to this know that. And you being a cave diver for so long, you know that. But in the diving world, in just open water diving, and I don't have all of the terminology at the top of my head, but is access an issue there as well, as much as it is in the cave world?
Yeah, unfortunately, absolutely it is. And, you know, it runs the gamut. Often the caves are on land that's privately owned, which I'm sure you're familiar with. And particularly with cave diving, people are afraid of the attendant legal risks because the reputation from prior mistakes and the evolution of the sport is such that so many people, unfortunately, have perished that the access can be very hard to come by if people aren't familiar with the sport. There's little cabals within the community. I'm sure that's true in dry caving as well, where people are very protective of their, you know, what they perceive as their cave, or they try to limit access, or you need specific guides, which can often make sense, but you need a guide to go to certain areas for safety and otherwise. I think sometimes it tends to be more otherwise and more of a protection scheme, but yeah, it's always a challenge. And on one level, and I remember this more so in the past than today, but there was also a lot of attention to overpopularizing the sport of cave diving because of the risks. And particularly in the 90s, I think that was very prevalent. And so there were movements within the industry, within the community, I should say, to sort of downplay caving and cave diving in the sense that they only wanted people that were legitimately interested in cave diving. They didn't want, people who weren't there so much for the caving, but for the machoism that I think it can often be perceived as. And they wanted to try to keep that element out by keeping the sport itself kind of a secret.
Did you run into much of that in the making of this film? I mean, you said it was an issue back in the 90s, but it still kind of is, especially in the caving world.
Yeah, it is. I think it's come around quite a bit because the training standards are larger now. The equipment access is easier. I mean, there's whole companies that provide technical diving equipment, where in the 90s, that really wasn't true. I mean, when I took my class, my BC, I made. There was only one company that made it. A lot of the equipment was handmade. The lights, like the Lamar English lights from back then, they were all handmade, you know, out of a garage. And that was common. You know, now you have companies like Dive Right, and there's X Deep and a whole bunch of other companies that specialize in like cave diving equipment. And so the industry itself's come a long way from that. And because the commerce element came into it, obviously those people are going to market and promote the sport because that's their business. Right. So I think some of that attitude went away, but when it comes down to access to specific caves, there are still groups that I think overly protect caves and try to, you know, have only the right people or their chosen people have access to them.
Mm. And Jonathan, let's bring it to the media perspective as a filmmaker. It's a lot different now than it was in the 90s. You know, this is a fractured media landscape. Everyone's attention is sort of fragmented. And so doing something like an IMAX or OmniMax film right now doesn't have the same kind of an impact as it maybe did back in the 90s, in that there's a lot more for people to consume. And so now things like this podcast, which would, I think, have been a lot less comfortable back in the 90s, is a little more comfortable now because we're narrow casting, aren't we? We're finding people who are interested in this, but also something like an IMAX film or an OmniMax film, that's enjoyable to everyone. And I think what a lot of people are realizing is that you can show somebody that who is never going to go in a cave their entire life, but they'll sit in a comfortable theater and see this where you did all the work to bring them to this place.
Most of the theaters that show these types of films are what we call institutional theaters. They're in science museums and aquaria. They're places where families take their kids. And these are films that appeal to families You know, they're not too scary. They're not horror films. They're science. They're generally very sciencey because they are in science museums. They're educational films. And you get a broad spectrum of people that go see them. Most of the people that go to see these, not all, I mean, a lot of the people will hear about this film in your podcast and they will seek it out. But, you know, the average person that is there, they've taken the kids to the Museum of Science on a Saturday and they're probably going to take in a movie and they're going to go look at the new exhibits and they're going to, you know, have some fun and, you know, go to the science museum. They're going to have lunch and they're going to go down to the theater and see what's playing. And there's usually a couple of films and they'll have to pick one. And they're going to go in there, and the role of this film is to give people an experience that will impress them and give them a feel for a place they're probably never going to go. And most – you very rarely see an IMAX film about something kind of plain Jane. It's always kind of, you know, Everest or, you know, caves or scuba diving on coral reefs or, you know – and these films are their whole role is to take people places that they wouldn't normally go in a way that you just can't get on television or on Netflix or on, you know, your laptop watching YouTube. You know, we've made some, I would dare say, if I can brag a little bit, some pretty awesome cave diving videos on our YouTube channel, but they are not the same as seeing it in an IMAX theater in 3D. They're not the same, or on a dome. It's like it's a whole different experience. And that is what I love about the format. It is the biggest format in the world. And it is the most, to use a cliche, the most immersive format in the world. And it is really fun to produce in that. And to circle back to your original question, I realize I got off topic. The camera technology, the 8K cameras that are now out have the resolution to do IMAX as well as or better than 70 millimeter motion picture film. And they are a fraction of the size and they can carry more than 3 minutes of film. So we can go into a cave. Todd and I filmed in a place in Abaco called the Fangorn Forest, named after Tolkien's magical Middle Earth. And it is a double stage dive to get there, which means that it takes 4 scuba tanks to get there. It's about a half a mile swim in. So it takes about an hour to get to Fangorn from the entrance. Then you have about 10 minutes to work. Then it takes an hour to swim back, and then it's an hour of decompression. So it's more than a 3-hour dive to get there and to film there. And you have 10 minutes to film. And an IMAX camera will not fit. You have to go through passages that are far too small. In fact, Todd got stuck on the way out.
Oof.
That's in the film. It's an awesome sequence. and you couldn't carry enough film. If you got there, you wouldn't have enough film to shoot it. Even if you could get the camera that far into the cave. And lastly, film is not very good with low light situations. These cameras are much better in low light. We can hand carry enough lighting to actually light a big room. We were carrying about 8 of these canister lights that are about this big. They're about the size of a coffee can. And they are 30,000 lumen LED lights that are completely self-contained. So you imagine, if you can imagine a coffee can that one end is brighter than the headlights on your car, and we can stick them all around the cave to light it up.
Wow.
To give you an example of the alternate, McGillivray Freeman did a film, an IMAX film about 15 years ago called Journey to Amazing Caves. It was a terrific film. It's one of my favorite IMAX films of all time. Brilliantly done. And there's one cave diving sequence in the film. And it was shot by Howard Hall, and it was directed by Wes Skiles, legendary, legendary underwater cinematographer for caves. First of all, they did it in Dos Ojos in Mexico, which is a cave that it's pretty big. They could get a film camera into, a big film camera. And to get enough light into that room to actually shoot it with film, they drilled holes from the jungle down into the cave to bring the electrical lighting down to run the HMI lights from a generator on the surface. Because back then they did not have lights that were bright enough to light up a cave scene for the film camera. They could never, ever, ever have shot Fangorn Forest with that camera. They couldn't light it. They couldn't get the camera into it. There's so many ways they couldn't do it. This 8K technology, which we've only had for 5 years, 4 years, is like the only way we were able to film Fanghorn Forest and these amazing LED light technology that we have now. So we have technology now that lets us do things we could never do 10 or 15 years ago, even 5 or 6 years ago.
Well, and what could change in the next 10 or 15 years? What are the limits now? I mean, I'm sure that it's beyond our comprehension maybe at the moment, but have you thought about that?
Well, the cameras continue to get better. They get better in low light. They get better in high contrast. They get more pixels. So, yeah, I mean, from the cave exploration world point of view, like it's getting easier to be a cave diver with technology. Like, I mean, just 10 years ago, people used canister lights for cave diving. So you had a canister on your back that was like, I don't know, the size of a small scuba tank that was the battery pack. And then you had a wire that came around to the light head that you held in your hand or you clamped the back of your hand. And this thing was not very bright. This thing might have been, you know, 500 lumens, and it would maybe run you a couple of hours. And now I can carry literally a flashlight in my hand that's no bigger than a regular like flashlight with a couple of D cells in it, but it's an LED light that's got a high density lithium ion battery in it. And at 500 lumens, it'll run for 12 hours. And at full power, it's at 4,000 lumens. It's way brighter than you would ever need. And it'll run for 90 minutes. And I don't have a canister or a wire. And this thing is like this big, and I can carry four of them if I want. You know what I mean? Like I can carry so much lighting now. The idea of a light failure is laughable. You know, on a casual cave dive, we're diving for Blue World, I'm carrying like six lights that can run 6 hours. There's two on my camera. There's two on my helmet. There's one in my fanny pack. There's one hanging on the front. Like I have so many lights. It's like the idea of not having a light is like, we don't even think about that anymore. Whereas back in the day, people died because their light went out.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and Todd, how many tanks were you bringing with you on this particular tour? The one where Tefangorn Forest.
I think Fangorn, was it six total? Because we had we dropped a couple bottles, plus we had oxygen that we left.
Plus oxygen for Deco.
So you had compressed air. Okay, yeah.
Well, we had
We had nitrox. Nitrox and oxygen. Oxygen for the decompression and nitrox to reduce that decompression time as we went in. Mm. So it's different than air in that you have a higher percentage of oxygen you're putting into it.
So we were not on rebreathers. Most of the people that go to Fanghorn would do it on a rebreather. We were doing it on open circuit. Because I'm not a rebreather guy yet.
Mm. That's a whole other thing, right?
That's a whole other thing.
Todd, you have experience with rebreathers?
I do. I've been diving a rebreather for about 7 years now, actually. Mm. And I think, you know, that's an area of great technological change as well. And, you know, that actually rebreather technology predates scuba. But just in the last 20 years, really, because they can be computer controlled and the electronics have gotten better and our overall equipment and manufacturing have gotten better. They've come back around full circle and now they're becoming very common, almost more common in the tech industry than scuba alone.
Todd, I wanted to ask you this, and Jonathan, I'm sure that you've experienced this too. I'm going to ask the standard cave diver story, Haloclyn. Have you been through one, swimmed up through one?
You're in virtually every cave.
It's in the film, actually. We go through the Haloclyn because the crystal caves of Abaco, they start in freshwater. And once you hit between 30 and 50 feet, depending on time of year and such, you go through it. So we take the audience through that, actually, through that experience where it's mixing between the two and a little bit of brackish water.
I'm sure that your film, Jonathan, is probably the best illustration of that. But does it even come close to experiencing it in person?
It is really hard to convey. It really is hard to convey on screen. I think we did a pretty good job of it. But there are places where we've seen the Haloclyn in a way that I don't think you could really show people except with a native 3D rig. Like in Mexico, you can swim along like right at the Halocline in a cave that's been undisturbed for a long time. And so the Halocline has become like paper thin. And so you almost can see the ripples on the Halocline, almost as if you're like a boat on the surface of the saltwater layer, but you're actually swimming in the freshwater layer. And like you could put your hand down into the saltwater layer and like feel the temperature difference sometimes too. And you'll see like ripples going out ahead of you is almost as if you've dropped a stone into the saltwater. It's so wild. It's wicked hard to show on screen. But when you have a diver ahead of you that's swimming in it and you're the second guy in the cave, you get all the swirls coming off their fins. And that's what we show in the, in ancient caves. It's a little bit easier to illustrate that way. If you Google ancient caves, one of the earlier links will be to MacGillivray Freeman's website, which is our distributor. And they have on there the show times of where it's coming. People should understand that these type of institutional giant screen films, they don't come out like a Hollywood film on a weekend and they run for a week and then they're gone. They will go into your local museum's IMAX theater probably and run about 6 months is average. And your local theater will get it when they have time in their schedule. And so it may be that just because Ancient Caves is out now, they might have already signed contracts for some other films that are going to show for the next 6 to 12 months. And so they might be scheduling it for 2023 or 2024. These films, it takes about 5 years for a new giant screen film to like percolate through all the theaters that are going to get it. So a lot of people are like, when's it coming to my theater? And the answer is it'll probably come to your theater, but it might take a year or two. So you have to kind of keep an eye on the schedule on the website. So it is rolling out in a lot of cities right now and in internationally, but the list is nowhere near right now as big as it will be.
So cavers, contact your local large screen theater and ask them to bring it.
And tell them you want it. If you have a local science museum that's got a giant screen theater in it, IMAX or otherwise, call the theater director or send them an email. You can usually find their email address and say, hey, I want to get this Ancient Caves film. Because believe it or not, that does make a difference because theater directors often have a very hard time deciding what film to get. There's a lot of new films that come out every year, and sometimes they're in a quandary and they don't know, and they don't hear from people that often. And so you'd be surprised. One or two people dropping an email can move the needle actually quite a bit.
Any final thoughts before I wrap it up?
Thank you for your time today. Yeah.
Thanks for having us. Thanks for giving us a chance to talk cave diving. We love talking cave diving.
Jonathan Bird, director and cinematographer for the new giant screen film, Ancient Caves, and Todd Kelly, fellow cave diver. Thank you so much for your time. Thank you for the movie. I can't wait to see it, Jonathan.
Let us know how you like it, and thanks for having us.
Thanks, Todd.
Thanks, Matt.
Oh, how incredible. Ancient Caves, if it's near you, go see it. If it's not, you heard him. Email. Be a thorn in their side. We do have the power, as you heard. Thank you so much for listening. Thanks to our sponsor, El Spelio. Get a great light at elspelio.com and save $20 off any regularly priced order of over $300 with the promo code PODCAST. Thanks to our past sponsors as well, Swago, swagogear.com, Organic Robot Designs at organicrobotdesigns.com. Again, get involved with your local grotto. There's a link in the description of this podcast where if you don't know what your grotto is, you'll find it. And if you're a member of a grotto and you're not part of the leadership yet, then do that. If there are things you want your grotto to do and they're not doing it, chances are they want your help. So get involved. Organization, cleanups, all of that. You know what? Get involved because I can't. I was invited to do a cleanup next weekend and I can't do it because, family. But I'd be out there, man, if I didn't have to wrangle toddlers. Who we got next month? Gretchen Baker. Yeah, Gretchen Baker. Who, if you're involved in NCRC, you know that name. Or maybe even if you're not involved in NCRC, you know Gretchen Baker. I was so privileged to share an hour with her, and you'll hear it June 1st. Until then, thanks for listening. I'm Matt Pelser from the Central Indiana Grotto, and kill nothing but time.